here's your host of Shaping Success, Wes Tankersley.
Hey everyone, welcome to Shaping Success. I am your host, Wes Tankersley. Before we get started here, if you could please do a watch party if you're watching this live on Facebook. Like, share, and review it. Help me to grow the show if you're listening to it on podcast. Help me get a review on Apple Podcast. Help me to grow the show. Our next guest is John Forjas. He's a very funny writer, author, and many other things. I put too many slashes in his name. But John, thanks for taking the time to be on the show and welcome.
Thank you. I'm just dazzled by the tech, man, that commercial and then the intro with the music. I'm already grooving. I'm having a good time and I am ready to shape some damn success around here.
Oh, I love it. I love it. You know, I put writer and author on there and I was looking through the IMDb and there was two that really stood out to me, Married with Children and The Flash, but there's so much more to it. You said there was a bunch of slashes after there. Can you give us all the slashes of what else you are?
Yeah. Yeah, I was just laughing. With me and the shape of my life, I've done so many different things over the years that if you start putting slashes or making me a hyphenate, you can go to writer / author / poker player / poker expert / artist / mime / ventriloquist / Santa Claus on stilts / oh my gosh. In the 1980s, I wrote softcore porn in the San Fernando Valley. Do I have to put that on the slash line too?
Hey, that wasn't on your IMDb.
It was not on my IMDb. I don't know why. No, those weren't movies. Those were magazines. I wasn't good enough to write the script for The Pizza Man Arrives. Because I kept on trying to put too much subtext into it. You know, the pizza's here. Where do you go with that? Where, as an actor, where can you take that? Well, actually, as a porn actor, we know where you can take that. So never mind.
Oh, man. So let's talk about where it kind of all started for you. Where did this journey that you've been on through all these different careers and things that you've done start?
I can point to it exactly. I was a few years out of college, just a couple of years out of college. I had taken a degree in creative writing, and I had worked my way up to a modestly high level of status as an advertising copywriter. And as I approached the age of 25, I said to myself, I got to get out of this career right now while I still can, because I don't want to wake up when I'm 40 years old feeling like I had squandered my youth trying to make the world safe for advertising. That just wasn't where my head was at. So I quit that job and became a singer-songwriter, because that was the most immediate way I could connect with an audience. So the starting point that you're referring to is the point when I decided to stop being time managed by my job and take full responsibility and full ownership for all of my time. If I can go a little deeper here, because I think there's a really good point to be made.
Go
I didn't just
it.
Jump into it. I didn't just say to my, you know, I didn't just walk in and say, screw you, boss, I'm out of here in a fit of pique. I actually went at it strategically. In the summer of 1985, I had a three-day weekend. It was the 4th of July weekend. And I said to myself, okay, I want to be this singer-songwriter guy. So here's the proposition. I'm going to spend the Friday, Saturday, Sunday of 4th of July pretending it's work days. I get up in the morning. I work on my scales. I write some songs. I do some writing. I work on my mind, body, spirit, all that stuff. But mostly, these are days to prove that I know what it means to self-motivate and self-activate and have a productive day. And if I can come out of this experience saying I've had 1, 2, 3 productive days in a row, then I can go to my boss and say I can leave this job because I no longer have any doubts that when it comes time to being productive, I'm going to have what it takes to be productive. So for anybody who's in that situation, and I'm sure there are people like that, you measure your fantasy version of being on your path or in your practice against your current reality of the job you're in, and you really want to leave the job and enter the practice, you can practice being in your practice in advance and prove to yourself that when you need to self-motivate and deliver the goods for yourself, you'll be there and you can do it.
That's amazing insight right there. I really love that. And I listened to a podcast earlier that you were in just to kind of get a little more background. And there's so much stuff that you've been through. I'm amazed that at a young age that you decided that that was important enough to do it that way, because I'm 40 and it, you know, at 38, I kind of took this path of I'm done doing this because I don't like it. I'm moving into this. And right now this is a dream of what I can do, but I continue to practice it every you know, once a month so that I can get to that point where I can do it full time and it can be the thing that I want to do.
Well, there are a couple of things. One is I'm attracted to new things like a magpie is attracted to shiny objects. I just go. I go for new things. So I think it was kind of in my wiring that I was going to have an original or a self-motivated or self-built career anyhow. But the other thing is, from the start, I didn't fear bad outcomes. I wasn't worried about trying something and failing and looking bad or failing and getting set back in my career. That just I just accepted early on that rejection was going to be part of what I dealt with. And if I dealt with it effectively, it wouldn't be a problem for me. So friends say that I have a gift for reducing complex concepts to trivial one-liners. And this would be an example of that. Don't fear bad outcomes. If you don't fear bad outcomes, then you can try anything. Because the worst that can happen is it doesn't work out. And you told yourself in advance that the worst that can happen isn't that bad. And I know that sounds a little bit cheesy or maybe even self-manipulating. We can glorify it by giving it a title. It's actually called a useful fiction. If you say to yourself, I'm going to try this thing, and if it doesn't work out, I'll still be okay. Part of you knows you're kind of lying to yourself. Part of you fears, I'll go through it, it won't work out, and I'll hurt, and I know I'm going to hurt. But now this voice inside my head is saying, but try it, and it might be okay. And even if I know that voice is lying to me, I can still accept the lie because it gives me so much motive or so much room to do what I want to do anyhow, which is achieve creatively, be in my practice, make my life rise.
Were you the guy that was there on the high dive and wasn't afraid to jump off the first time?
Oh, no, 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 no. I could never do that. What? I fear a bad outcome of a broken neck. Actually, I had a conversation with a friend. I said, you know, maybe it's not even just fear. Don't fear bad outcomes. Maybe just viewed through a certain filter, there are no bad outcomes. And then he just rattled off a list of really horrific outcomes, bad things that can happen to people. And I realized I can't stand there.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't say be reckless. I'm not reckless in my own life. I'm reckless in my professional life. If somebody came along today, maybe somebody listening to this podcast, let me see if I can work up a dream scenario. Somebody listening to this podcast is running a school for bootstrap filmmakers in South Africa, and they need someone to help them understand what a story and a script look like, and they can't pay me anything but airfare, and they don't know where I'm going to live when I get there, but if I want to come, they'll be glad to have me. I would say yes before they even got to the end of the sentence.
It's such a great, like, if you, it's so weird because most people feel that way. Like, I felt that way my whole life, that if I do this, this is going to be the reaction of what's going to happen to it. So you're afraid. You don't want to go and jump out. You don't want to go take that leap into doing something because you're afraid of the outcome, like you said. But I think that when you come to the point that even though something bad could happen, there is something good that could happen from that bad thing. And and not, you know, I mean, jumping off the diving board might not be that bad unless there was like concrete below you. But no. That's the thing. It's like there's a point where you have to make the choice. Is it worth the risk? And if you fail, then what are you going to do when you fail? You can make the next best chance. You have input on what it took. You did the research and now you're going to do it again. And maybe you'll fail again, but you'll fix it the next time until you get it right.
I think there's another way of looking at it that complements what you just said. I think of myself as being in my practice, and I can be in a practice of anything, writing, stand-up comedy, art, to take three examples. But if I'm in my practice, then part of what I do is try. And with every aspect of trying, with every instance of trying, there's failure, there's success in some mixture. But the labels that we assign, this was a failure, that was a success, they become less important because the thing that I'm focusing on is I'm in my practice, I want to be in my practice, I want to stay in my practice, and the way I do these things is by iterating, trying again. And if the outcome of that thing is something that someone wants to call a failure, okay, let them. If the outcome of that thing is something that someone wants to call a success, okay, let them. But for me, in the middle of it, doesn't matter whether it's a success or a failure, as long as it does the one thing I need it to do, which is to create continued opportunity for me to be in the one place I want to be in my practice. And further to that, I know my practice is going to last till I die. So the stuff that happens to me this week in 1985 or this week in 1992 or this week in 2026 doesn't matter, because all I want to do is be in my practice and stay in my practice. And I've arranged the circumstances of my life that I get to do exactly that. So winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Man, gosh, you really got me thinking. That's I think it's amazing, though. But where did this thought process come from, though? Because, I mean, you said you talked about being 25 and thinking I'm going to go get in and I'm going to be in the music industry or whatever. Obviously, that you had to have someone tell you when you were younger, or you had to have some sort of influence that made you think that way.
Perhaps. I mean, when I was at that age, I was reading what I used to call head books, you'd call them self-help now. Uh-huh. Everything from a kind of a mystical point of view to just very practical, this is how to think about yourself kind of thing. But there were two breakthroughs that mattered for me. One was I understood at a pretty early age that if I wanted to learn how to do something better, I could find someone to pay me to teach it. Teaching is how I really learn. So this idea of I got to figure out what I'm doing and how I'm doing and why I think about it, informed my efforts to be a teacher. I couldn't be a good teacher unless I could understand my own thought processes. And then the other thing is this idea of when we're operating creatively, we're operating on two levels of thought. One level of thought is the work that we're doing, and the other level of thought is kind of looking over our own shoulder and watching ourselves work and thinking about our process and looking at our choices and asking why we do what we do on the page or with clay or on stage, whatever your practice, your art form might be. So this idea of engaging with the work and examining the process behind the work, that's the quirk of my mind that lets me look under the hood of all these different subjects and figure out how they really work and how they operate. I did it with poker. I did it with art. I'm doing it right now with stand-up comedy. I'm writing a book on stand-up comedy to further my understanding of how to be a good stand-up comic.
Man, it's so interesting. So we talked about, you said that at 25 you're going to be a writer and a guitar player, right? So
yeah.
What happened from there?
Singer-songwriter. What happened? I'll tell you. Yeah. I'll tell you what happened. I spent 5 years singing and playing guitar on the folk circuit in New England, kind of like Bob Dylan, until I discovered that there were two things I could not do particularly well, sing and play guitar. That's just where my talents lie. So I pointed the wagons west and came out to California. This would be 1985. I didn't quite know what I was going to do. I just knew that I was going to be a bigger writer than I had before. So I'd been a songwriter, but I thought there was more to it than that. Through a friend of a friend, I got connected to someone who had some experience in situation comedy, and I asked him if he would teach me what he knew. And he said he'd be very glad to, because one thing that Hollywood writers understood at the time, everybody hates Hollywood writers, nobody helps writers except writers. So there was a very strong ethic for writers to help writers. He said, I require two things of you, that you pay attention to what I'm saying and that you pay it forward. He didn't use those words exactly, but that's what it amounted to. He said, I'm endowing you with some knowledge that will be useful to you. Your only responsibility is to endow other people with knowledge when it's your turn. And I kind of took that part and made a whole big meal out of it. Like I've spent the last quarter of a century traveling around the world teaching and training writers how to make TV shows and how to write scripts. In between, I wrote for Married with Children, Head of the Class, Charles in Charge, The Flash. I didn't have a stellar Hollywood career, but it lasted long enough for me to get my pension with the Writers Guild, so that's a big deal. But it mostly pointed me to what my real calling was, which was to be further out in the world making television and films on the frontier of knowledge, where my skill set could really make a difference to people who didn't have skills. I'll give you one example if I can. In the late 90s and then again toward the end of the 2000s, I made two television shows in Nicaragua, where the understanding of what goes into making a television show was fairly limited. So my impact was quite large. And that's the kind of opportunity that I've sought over and over again. Where can I go where I can be a difference maker, not just in individual writers' lives, but in the kind of the trajectory of the whole career? Which is not to say that working in Hollywood sucked, but just between you and me, for me, working in Hollywood sucked.
I wouldn't doubt that. It seems like it's quite a racket. There's a lot of, like, I feel like if we think that, you know, the White House is political, it's probably pretty political there.
I'm going to go for a joke. I'm going to go for a joke here. Right. Scratch the surface of a Hollywood producer. What do you get? More surface.
Jeez. So,
but there's nothing wrong with Hollywood per se. There's a saying in Hollywood. Do you know the word mensch? Is that word in your vocabulary?
I've heard mensch it before.
Mensch is a Yiddish
word. Yep.
It means a good person, a good guy, a good Joe is a mensch. And there's a saying in Hollywood, assholes work with assholes and menches work with menches. Uh-huh. So there are a lot of environments that are really competitive and kind of toxic, but it works for people who enjoy operating in competitive, toxic environments. There are other environments in Hollywood that are more relaxed. I want to say nurturing. And that's also a creative space that can be really fruitful. So there's more than one model. There's more than one way of making things work. But one of the things that drew me to working in other countries where I could make such a difference was also I got to implant my systems, what I thought leadership should look like, what I thought being respectful and helpful to other writers was like. And most importantly, what it means to step outside the ego and serve the work. In the writers' rooms that I run and have run, I'm always about, we're not here to serve the ego, we're here to serve the work. And if you understand that core idea, everything else falls into place right behind it quite beautifully. In fact, you don't even need to take that idea into a group setting. And just as an individual, I'm looking at here, okay? Here's an example. This is a recent graphic I did. You won't be able to see this on the podcast, but it's a really beautiful logo for a product, service, or phenomenon called Slacker Wednesday. And I produced a version of it and showed it to a friend of mine, and he said that the work around the letters was really sloppy and it needed to be improved. And my first reaction was, ouch, my feelings. I just got told something bad about my work. I don't feel good. But then I reminded myself, I'm in service of the work. I want the work to be as best as it can be. My friend has told me that I've hit the limitation of my skill set, and in order to get what I want out of this project, I got to up my game a little. So now I'm in service of the work. I'm aware of my feelings, but I'm not held back by my feelings. And that's what happens when you're in your practice and in service to the work.
You know, I feel dumb for asking this question, but have you written a self-help book?
I have written a book called How to Live Life, which is a little on the nose. You can find it on my website, johnvorhaus.com. But I would say that for people who want to use my work in a self-help sense more practically, get your hands on The Comic Toolbox, How to Be Funny Even If You're Not. And even if you're not a comedy writer, you're going to see a lot of the stuff that I've been talking about reflected in that work. And it'll show you how to jump into creativity like slipping into a warm bath. And you'll have a lot of fun with it, and you'll come out of it feeling like, hey, maybe I am funny, even if I'm not. But more to the point, if you're looking for the next level of this, the drug that is John Vorhaus, The Comic Toolbox is a good, strong entry gateway.
You were talking about a mensch, right? And I look at this in a certain way. Like, I feel like I've said this a lot of times on my podcast, in videos and things like that I've done, but you surround yourself with those like-minded people. And that's the way that I look at it. When those good people that you're looking for something good are together, good things are going to happen and those people will find you. And then when you're an asshole, you're going to find those people too, because you really get what you put out of it. And I feel like just by what you're doing, you're trying to create a better place for other people. And that just attracts people. Cause I mean, it's amazing listening to how positive the things that you're talking about are and how much of a difference that they can make in someone's life. So I think it's great. I really enjoy the conversation. So
thank you. I want to reflect on a conversation I had yesterday, the day before. I gave somebody half an hour of my time for free. She just wanted to brainstorm something and sounded interesting to me. We jumped on a Zoom. We had a chat. And she thanked me for it at the end, which is appropriate. But as I was setting up my Zoom screen today, I was reflecting on it. I am in service. And I know I'm in service because I am doing things for other people. Not with a conscious idea that they're going to reward me for it. The people who pay me an awful lot.
Yeah.
But the part of me that's in service is just looking at the human package that I contain and ask, what can I do to make lives rise? Because if I make lives rise, I feel really good.
Yep.
And this is this is kind of a controlling idea. People say, oh, if you're in service, you're somehow weak or below other people. You're yielding your autonomy. You're like a slave. Like I used to think this about nurses. How could somebody degrade themselves to change a bedpan? It's the most impossible thing in the world, according to my conception. But then I realized the person who's doing that work takes self-identification from it. I am a nurse. I am in service. When I'm doing the thing that makes me feel good, I feel good. It shouldn't surprise us to discover that. Cops are the same way. Cops feel like if they're doing the thing that turns them on and engages them the way they want to be, then they're in service. That's really going to be a bad example. I'm backing off that. Let me try it a different way. I know an EMT, an emergency service tech, an emergency medical tech, and he says, the only time I really enjoy my job is when somebody's in bad trouble. Like if somebody's not in a screwed up situation, a really bad situation, I'm just sitting around twiddling my thumbs. Yep. But when I get to engage and solve a problem, like saving a person's life, then I feel like my intention for myself is being met. And if you're out there in the audience and you're asking myself, why don't I feel good about where I am? Maybe ask yourself, is my intention for myself currently being met? And if the answer is no, then that's not the time to say, therefore, I'm a sad, pathetic loser. That's the time to say, therefore, I recognize that there's a gap between where I am and where I want to be. And there are steps that I can take, small steps, to start to narrow that gap so I can move toward my intended state of being, toward my intent, and start to feel better about myself step by step. Because, yeah, I'm not where I want to be, but at least I'm not where I was, and I'm moving toward my target. And once that forward momentum starts, then you're on your path, then you're in your practice, and then you're ready to go.
Ah, that's great. That is great. You know, and that's the thing. It's like everyone's desire for doing something is completely different. And although that person is hurt with EMT, they feel like they're being fulfilled because they're doing their job that they set out to do. So it's a mm-hmm. great way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. And I could talk about this all day, but I want to talk about a little bit about the poker thing, because this seems like another different, interesting angle that you have going on as well. What got you into poker? And you've written some books on poker as well, right?
I've written 10 books on poker. Yeah. I've co-authored one of the top 2 books on poker. We'll come to that in a second. In 1988, the Writers Guild went on strike and I couldn't work. I found myself going into the card rooms in Southern California, plunked down my $20, and they went through me like a freight train through the wind. And I said to myself, well, that's fun, but I suck. And if I'm going to do this, I got to get good. How can I get good? I reached out to a card magazine and I said, look, I know nothing about poker, but I'm going to learn. And while I learn, I want to write about it. And they thought that was a good idea, which I always reflected. That just goes to show, no matter how bad my judgment is, there's always someone whose judgment is a little bit worse. But that meant that by the time poker caught on in the early 2000s, I had already been writing about poker in magazines for years. And at that, when it started to get hot, I reached out to my agent and I said, looks like in this hot poker market, I think I could sell a book. And what he told me, I'll never forget. He said, I can't sell a book, but I know I can sell 3. And it kind of blew my mind. I said, what do you mean? He said, I have buyers for poker book series. I said, I don't have more than one book of poker in me. I don't even know if I have one book of poker in me. He said, you have as many books of poker in you as you need, and you'll prove it when you get the contract. And he wasn't wrong. I did, in the space of about 5 years, I wrote, let me see if I can rattle them off, Killer Poker, Killer Poker Online, Killer Poker Hold'em Handbook, Killer Poker No Limit, Killer Poker Shorthanded, Killer Poker Online 2, then a novel about poker, then a book called Poker Night for Home Poker. And then I collaborated with Annie Duke, the world's best woman poker player, arguably one of the top 10 poker players there is. And we collaborated on a book called Decide to Play Great Poker, which is, in my estimation, one of the top 2 poker books behind Doyle Brunson's Super System. I'll stack it up against all the rest of them because all the brilliant concepts are hers and all the pretty words are mine. So that's a pretty potent combination. But let's look at the roots. There's something I wanted to learn how to do. I found someone to pay me to teach it. Then when an opportunity came up for me to practice my craft of writing, connected to something that I cared about, poker, I was off and running. And when poker was hot, all through the first decade of the 2000s, I wrote book after book after book, not fearing bad outcomes, knowing I had to meet a deadline, and not being too precious about making sure that I stand out of the way of my own fear is the best way I can put it. That experience taught me what it means to be a steady diet writer, someone who can be counted on, get up in the morning, sit at the desk, bang on the keyboard, make stuff happen. So coming out of that poker experience, it was easy to write other books on other subjects because I suddenly had this 10-year boot camp of writing a lot of words under a lot of pressure. Good times.
Man, that's amazing.
And poker was great, by the way. That world, I'm not of that world, but the high rollers, they do crazy things like credit card roulette for dinner tabs of $1,000 and more. Everybody just throws in their credit card and whoever's picked pays. That's just flagrant disregard for money, which, by the way, if you want to be a successful poker player, that's a great quality to have.
Yeah.
Because you can't play poker effectively if you're afraid. And yeah. These guys were definitely not afraid.
Yeah,
there's I was afraid.
A lot of risk in it. So there's one story
not
that I
excited.
There's one story that I want to talk about because the poker that is just an amazing story on poker. But you talk about fear a lot and being afraid to do something. And I had heard that you said something about being Santa Claus on stilts. And mm-hmm. I understand that you had never been on stilts before when you decided to do this. What was the thought process in that?
The motivating factor was $30 an hour. I saw an ad in a newspaper. This was in Boston. I was 25 or 6, hustling, trying to make a buck. I'd quit my job, so I needed to get gigs. And I was hustling for gigs, singer-songwriter gigs, singing telegrams. For a while, I did Dylan Graham's, you know, happy birthday to you. That was pretty funny. But I saw an ad in the paper saying, obviously it was Christmas time, we need Santa Claus on stilts. So I don't fear bad outcomes. I got on the phone. I said, hey, I understand you need a Santa Claus on stilts. The guy says, do you walk on stilts? I said, when do you need me to start? He said, Monday. I said, I'll be there. I never said I walked on stilts. I hadn't ever walked on stilts up to that point. I didn't lie to the guy, but I did have a weekend to learn how to walk on stilts, and that seemed like it was plenty of time. And in fact, it was. So
I love it.
So I was Santa Claus on stilts. It was really a one-off, but when I think about how many times I've reflected on that story and how much value people get out of it in terms of what it means to take reasonable risks, I think I probably got $90 for the gig, 3 hours work. Sounds about right.
Yeah.
But I got a story that I've been dining out on ever since.
Yeah.
So remember, kids, if somebody will pay you $30 an hour to walk on stilts, be sure to say yes. Because what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah.
And I know what you think. I know what you think. You think you'll fall. Can I tell you that I protected myself? I mean, I'm not immune to risk. I decided that Santa Claus needed a giant candy cane, like a 6 or 7 foot candy cane that he would hold in his hand and conveniently place on the ground whenever he needed help staying steady. Santa, even on stilts, is nobody's fool.
Oh, man. John, this has been an awesome conversation, and I'm so glad that we got the time to chat because I feel like you're kind of a wealth of knowledge. I think that there's so much that you have to offer just by having, you know, a little 30-minute conversation with you. Where can people find you? What else can they do to get a hold of you?
To get hold of the whole Voorhoosian experience?
Yes.
Yes. Well, if you have my name, you have everything. Because my name is John Voorhaus, JohnVoorhaus, not exactly spelled like it sounds. But anyway, once you know that, then you have my website, because that's johnvoorhaus.com. That's right. You also have my Facebook name. I fly under the flag of John Voorhaus. You can go to Amazon and search my name and get all the books that are there. Go to my author page. Go to my own website, find a whole bunch of other books. You can go to Redbubble, drop my name into the search window there, and get all my artwork, stuff like this sexy mug that, again, you can't see if you're listening to the podcast, but I can tell you that it is worth $22.95 plus shipping and handling. And also, if you have my email address, if you have my name, you can probably figure out my email address because it's probably something like john.voorhaus@gmail.com. And since I am in service, I am interested in hearing what you have to say. So if you feel like it's appropriate to reach out, you're probably not wrong.
That's great. Well, you know, we're coming to the end here and we have one last question that I always ask every single guest that's on the show. And we've talked a lot about success and how you've created that, but how would you define it? What is the shape of your success?
This is a lock. It's so easy. Let me see how many words it is. Four words. What is success? Success is enjoying your days. I don't think that's four words. God, I wish I hadn't bothered to count because the impact is missing. Guys, success is enjoying your days. If you wake up in the morning excited to be doing what you're doing, then you're on the right track. And the stuff that you think is about success, what the cliche calls the trappings of success, money, fame, glory, power, blah, blah, blah. For the kind of life experience that I think you want to have, and I only think that because you wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you didn't want to have that kind of life experience, something authentic, something that'll make your own life rise, something that will give purpose and meaning to your path and your journey, then success is enjoying your days. If you set the goal of getting to that and being in that, everything else is going to pretty much fall into place behind it.
Hey, it's been great having you on. I love the story. I love that we got a chance to do this again. And I hope to hear more. And now I have to go buy some books. So thanks again. Thank you.
Go sports team.
Yeah. All right. Hey, everyone. Well, that is the end of our show. This was a great interview with John. I hope that you enjoyed it. Like I said before, please review, share this if it's moved you and helped you in any way. Until next time, I challenge you to find the shape of your success. We'll be right back.